And we're here in the studio, Chuck Van Zyl, one half of the Ministry of Inside Things, and we're also joined by Art Cohen, the other half of the Ministry of Inside Things. And before we get into the more esoteric things, I think we probably should clear up a couple of origin stories. So, many people have been perplexed and confused by the name Ministry of Inside Things, and would you tell me the origin of the name?
Yeah, you know, I don't think we have anything on our website or in our bio about that, but I was at this film. It was a documentary about Leon Theremin, and I'm sure many of our stars and listeners have know of this this inventor and of this documentary. Somewhere in the middle of the documentary, the interviewer asked Leon Theremin about his disappearance and who took him and where he went. And I guess in the way he the only way he was able to describe the government agency that had disappeared him for so many years was he called them the Ministry of Inside Things. And when I just was really fascinated by that name. It really captured my imagination, and I turned to my friend sitting next to me and said, "Boy, that would be a great name for a group." And I don't know, at some point not too long in the future, the opportunity arose, and I started a group called the Ministry of Inside Things. Initially it had just myself and Peter Gulch in the group, and it was sort of an evolution of an earlier group we had called Exile. And then at some point, not long after that, we added a guitarist, Art Cohen. Then, as luck would have it, Peter Gulch dropped out eventually, and Art and I just have been going on together ever since as the Ministry of Inside Things.
Well, you kind of sort of slid into the other part of the origin story, and that is the origin of the two of you playing together. And so how exactly did that happen in terms of how did you find one another? You've actually known each other for an alarmingly long period of time, haven't you?
We've actually known each other since kindergarten, when we were both about 5 years old or so, and we were friends in elementary school, and then we're out of touch for a couple of decades, and then met up again. We both moved back into bought houses in the same neighborhood, and it turned out in the ensuing couple of decades since elementary school, we both had acquired a great love for space music and other unusual and fringe musics, and then one thing led to another, actually the story of where we first I said Chuck and Peter Gulch had formed the Ministry of Inside Things, and they were doing a concert. I think it was when it was still Exile, I believe, an Exile concert, and I was doing a solo set opening the bill. So during the sound check, I found myself jamming with Chuck and Peter, and that kind of it took a few years actually before I eventually joined the band. But that set the seed for like, hey, this is kind of interesting to add a guitar to what they were doing with their synthesizers, and so that's how that came about.
So I mean, were they playing space music during nap time in kindergarten? Or?
I think there was something in the water.
It must be.
Yeah, a lot of weird people came out of that class, apparently.
Seems like a very strange coincidence. You sort of mentioned, you know, having a common love of space music, and I'm sure sort of, you know, unusual types of music, and that sort of, you know, leads me to ask, I mean, what are you trying to accomplish in listening to these pieces? Clearly, you're not writing ooh baby love songs. What's, you know, what are you trying to get at with these pieces? What are you trying to find or create?
I think a lot of these pieces, I've been doing electronic music for a long time, and working with Art has been, over the past several years, has been quite a different experience. And I think before, when I was working with other synthesists, it felt like we were really expressing some kind of a feeling that was outside of music, like a cosmic yearning or interest in other planets or the, you know, science fiction themes. And we were really trying to portray that mood in our music, I think. And I've discovered from years of playing with art that I think our music that we realize as the Ministry of Inside Things, it really comes out of reacting to one another, and maybe even something of a tension that's built up during the collaboration process, where we where, you know, when we come together, we really don't know what we're going to do exactly when we come together for a practice session, and we just sort of hammer it out. And so we're sort of just expressing these abilities, or these reactions to one another, I think. Of course, like there also is, like with all electronic and space music and ambient music, we're trying to evoke a mood. I guess all music is that's the case for all music, really. But I think for our music, it's a special kind of mood. Like, it's kind of mysterious or ambiguous, and it's more like an atmosphere. It's we're trying to create a space. And I think the space that we have created comes out of these collaborations, as I've described, and I think it's one of the most unique kinds of music that I've ever heard.
Well, Arden, in the course of getting there, I mean, you have and continue to play in more sort of conventional rock formats of playing guitar and, you know, what might be even thought of as a sort of narrative form of, like, you know, you've got a first chorus, first structure, you've got melodies that sort of theoretically tell a story or move, you know, move the thing forward. And it seems to me like you're doing something very different in this band. Is that true, or is it just a different flavor of the same thing?
Well, it's both, actually, in that there's a strong melodic aspect that's certainly to what I do, and Chuck as well, because he plays a lot of nice synthesizer, you know, lead melody lines that really are tell a story with a melody. But we don't do verse, chorus, verse structures, and ooh baby, and any of that stuff. So it's a different kind of a narrative, really, that we're doing. But I mean, one thing that I particularly like about the space music and the music that we make, Chuck and I make with Ministry of Inside Things, is that it's not pure ambient. It's not just texture, and that we do have chords and melodies, and I enjoy, as a guitarist, kind of going into more than one place. So there's places where it really sounds like a rock guitar or like a guitar, which again, many ambient and space groups never go there at all. And yet there's other places where you would have to see us live to realize that sound is not coming from a synthesizer, that it's actually something I'm doing with a guitar.
Can you describe one of those things that you're doing that you might not think is a guitar?
You mean the techniques?
You don't have to go too far into the techniques.
This track that we're playing in the background is a good example. Yeah. It's almost all guitar.
Oh yes, here I'm doing glissando guitar, basically, and with a delay, and also a long loop as well. So I'm essentially playing the guitar with a brass tube, at bowing the strings, and of course, if you're familiar with guitar techniques, and you would recognize the sound as being that. For instance, David Allen from Gong is known for playing that, as well as Steve Hillage, also of Gong, known for using that technique. So you might recognize it, but on the other hand, it gives a sort of an infinitely sustaining note and an otherworldly timbre that you don't normally associate with a guitar.
Well, that's a good point in terms of sort of name-checking Gong, but obviously there's some other precedents. This isn't really out of nowhere. This doesn't, this music isn't completely, totally brand new. I mean, where's it coming from?
Well, that would be easy to answer. I've identified certain albums from the 70s that have been had very meaningful to me and a lot of other people, okay? And so they're like Phaedra and Rubicon and Ricochet by Tangerine Dream and Mirage and Picture Music by Klaus Schulze and Departure from the Northern Wasteland by Michael Honig, and I think and also some Ashra albums, you know, like New Age of Earth and Inventions for Electric Guitar. But they... What they all do is they're capturing a certain kind of a mood, and it seems to I've only been able to have been captured during that era. It might have been just because of the innovation or the invention of some new technology, you know, the synthesizer that was pretty new at that time, or maybe it was like more of a political thing. Maybe it was more like the people's consciousness were changing back then and allowed for this sort of experimentation. Anyway, that's what I look back at. You know, those are my, what do you call them, like touchstone albums, and I certainly owe a lot to those, to that music that was put out back then. An interesting thing was, though, that when, after Art and I had been playing for a while, we released a CD called, it was a live CD, it was called Everlasting Moment, and we worked real hard on getting it to sound good, and it's sort of a compilation of all these different live gigs that we did. But it wasn't until after I heard that CD that I realized, well, we're not really doing music like these Touchstone albums that I look back on so fondly. I know Art likes these albums too, but by working with Art, it took the music in a whole different direction away from these albums I just mentioned, this whole mood. And as I said before, it's the music that we've created back then and still do today. It's kind of hard to categorize, you know, because it's almost like this weird kind of progressive jam, space, ambient, experimental, avant-garde. It's a lot of different things, and I guess that comes from our backgrounds. You know, Art has an interesting background in music, and as do I, in the kind of stuff that I listen to and have absorbed and been influenced by. And I think it shows up on those albums.
Well, it's interesting you sort of mentioned in the course of it that Everlasting Moment was a collection of live performances. Actually, all your recordings have been a collection of live performances, right? And I mean, which actually, to me, suggests two questions. One is why, and the second is sort of like that grew out of you guys doing a lot of live gigs, which is unusual for electronic bands, isn't it? I feel like I don't know of that many electronic bands that play out a lot.
Yeah, we don't seem to get a whole lot of credit for that, but yeah, I think we've played out more than most bands have, most electronic bands have, although it's not on the front page of any kind of, well, I don't know, are there any magazines that write about this music? Probably not.
But it's true that most artists practicing in the electronic ambient space genre pretty much do it as a studio exercise and release off, you know, wonderful CDs, and occasionally might be coaxed out to a live concert, or many really won't be, refuse to be coaxed out to a live concert, or don't know how to do it live. And we're the opposite in that we never do studio recordings, and we only rehearse enough to be able to figure out how the pieces go so we can play them live, and the whole, everything that we do is about the actual live concert in front of an audience or on a radio station where there's an audience that we can't see, but we work out the pieces in that context, and then after playing them for a while we eventually figure out, you know, what the pieces are really about, and at some point edit out the best bits, and that's what ends up on the albums. Sort of the opposite process of the conventional, where you write the music, make the album, and then play some concerts to, you know, show the album material.
But you're you know quite a bit about the early psychedelic rock bands like Pink Floyd and the Grateful Dead, and that's sort of, as you've told me, that's the process that they used.
Yeah, to a large extent, that's true. I don't know if people are aware of that, but Pink Floyd, you know, all their classic albums, or pieces like Echoes, Dark Side of the Moon, I Wish You Were Here, they played that material for a year or two before they put out the album. And I'm an avid fan of that music and collector of live recordings and whatnot, and it's really fascinating to listen to the evolution. I really appreciate that method and have a great, I think it's a very good way to distill a piece of music and get it to a place where you really understand the possibilities, because of course the music that we play, it's not fixed. It's improvised music, but very much within a structure. So we know where it's going, but we don't know exactly how it's getting there or exactly what's going to happen in the different places. We know the rooms we're going to visit, but we aren't sure exactly what we're going to do in each room. And by playing it, you know, in many different performances, we explore the possibilities and we see what works and works better, what doesn't work as well. And these are techniques that, yes, the some of the classic psychedelic and space bands from the 60s and early 70s did some similar techniques. And I should add that I'm more directly influenced by, say, a band like Pink Floyd than I think Chuck is. He brings more from the cosmic electronic Berlin influence, which of course I'm also influenced by, but I have a more direct connection with that. And I think that's we bring that element to the Ministry of Inside Things music, which is one of the things that makes it, as Chuck said, somewhat of a different vibe than, say, an album like Phaedra, even though we touch on that, but we also sort of go back to the root source more and, you know, touch on an album like Saucerful of Secrets also.
Yeah, I guess our music is somewhere in between Phaedra and metal.
Right, with a detour via Live Dead or something like that.
Yeah. Well, as you were speaking about our live gigs, you know, I always have felt that, especially after I started playing with you, that I think we really get to understand what the music is by playing it out live, and I don't think we would get that, or would have this immediacy or this kind of insight into the music if we just did it in the studio. I don't know if other musicians feel that way, but that's the way I feel.
I'm not sure I know what you mean by that. What do you mean you find what the music is?
Well, if we play a song just for ourselves, like in our rehearsal space, it's interesting. You know, it's a interesting experience to do that and hear the music, but even if we just bring one or two, even if just somebody comes over and listens to us in the space while we are rehearsing, it changes things. So imagine how much more intense the experience would be when there's a nice sized audience there as well. And it, I don't know if this is a good way to explain it, but it seems to speed the process. You know, there's a lot to be said though for practicing and taking some time and figuring out what music is like. What you're supposed to do, but I don't know. I think it's worked out pretty well for us to get as Art outlined, just get a basic idea of what it is and take it out in front of people and play it for them and for ourselves too. It heightens the experience for us.
I think that's, yeah. I want to second that just knowing the audience is there, because I find even playing a radio concert where we can't see the audience but we know they're out there in Radioland, it just, I'll speak for myself, it focuses me in a way that doesn't happen in a rehearsal studio. Mm-hmm. And I think that really comes through in the music and allows us to, I say, explore it, but in a way where we have to always, we're always conscious of making it work, so we can't just do any old thing. We have to maybe push the boundaries gently or something like that.
Mm. Well, also, it actually is live. We come in contact with a lot of musicians, as I'm sure you do too, Jeff, that have, well, I guess nowadays there's all different ways to play music live, often with a computer, either with the actual samples being played back or using software that is, you know, automates like what other musicians would do. But everything that we're doing, like, is Art and I is really live. Like, we have the sequencer patterns are set. I usually, well, even not all the time. I mean, sometimes, most of the times they are set up ahead of time. But we don't use a computer, and we don't have, we do have some pre-recordings, but it's mainly just like the sounds of, you know, the river or nature sounds or something like that you know, like a sound effect kind of thing. But all the sounds you hear in our concerts and on our albums are created by Art playing something, you know, hitting his guitar a certain way, or me, tweaking my synthesizers. What's that test if a musician has a heart attack and nobody notices? Is it really a live concert?
Right.
So I think if Art and I both had a heart attack, there probably would just be silence, you know. So we're definitely a live group. To the limit.
Well, you mentioned the sequencers being preset, and it's one of these things. Of course, they're widely varied influences, but the structure of the sequencer is probably pretty central to your sound. What's so appealing about that kind of, you know, it's a kind of a classic sequencer sound too.
Well, I mentioned before about like these core albums that I like, you know, and that's really where this use of a sequencer to create these cycling rhythms, and of course an echo goes along with that to syncopate the sound. You know, I was heavily influenced by or love that sound, and I think what it is like if I'm listening to I was listening to a piece called on Rubicon the other day by Tangerine Dream, and realizing that it sounds like this, you know, there's like a spacey part at the beginning, and then like the sequence comes in, and there's a spacey part at the end, and it sounds like to me like when the sequence is coming up, it's like some engine is running, and I don't know if other musicians feel this way, but it feels like some weird kind of like cosmic engine that's just generating this atmosphere, or it's taking you someplace, and I think that's what the main virtue of space music is, that it is transportive rather than, you know, ambient music, which just opens up space. This space music feels like you're traveling through it. And the sequencer, it just gives it that sense of propulsion, whether it's, you know, like it's the star drive engine that's sending you across the galaxy, or just like your neurons firing inside your brain, I guess. Anyway, it seems like it's a sense of propulsion, I guess, is the simple answer that I like from sequencers.
I think this leads me to my next question. Is you currently on any prescription medications?
Well, I did have some caffeine a little while ago.
Okay, all right. Okay, all right. That's fine.
Jeff, it is 4:47 a.m.
That's a fair point.
I've been up since 6:30 yesterday.
Right, exactly. And it's kind of amazing that any of us are vertical still, I suppose, or semi reclining. The last couple of CDs have featured your photography on the packaging. Is there a relationship between that sort of expression and the musical expression?
I think so. I wasn't aware of this until an art gallery curator mentioned to me that this music that I'm into, it creates an atmosphere and a narrative that, but it's still quite ambiguous. It like sort of sets up this atmosphere or a scenario for people who listen to the music. And he told me he thought the photography was the same way. And I think I've described it accurately. And when I started doing the photography, it didn't really tie in very much or very well with. I didn't see any connection to my music, but after I heard this from a gallery owner, it made me think about it more. So I don't know. I don't have a really deep answer for that one, other than the connection is, it's like they're both very atmospheric and you know, set up put the viewer or the listener in a certain space so they can. They can experience a story of their own making, really.
Well, you mentioned the idea of playing out, whether it's in front of an audience or in a virtual audience over the radio. So that sort of presumes some kind of interaction with an audience. And is that happening? I mean, are you feeling something that the audience is doing? Is it really just the idea of someone looking over your shoulder or having to play for someone? Or have you gotten reactions from people that have influenced what you're doing?
Well, usually when we play, we prefer, our ideal concert is where the audience is basically quiet and listening while the music's going on. So we're not.
It doesn't always happen.
It doesn't always happen, right. And we sometimes play gigs in less than ideal venues. But our preferred mode and the gigs that we usually enjoy the most is where the audience has the opportunity to really deeply listen. And so we're not getting any direct feedback, like where they're cheering after the synth solo or something like that. But as I said before about like folk, like knowing that they're there, there's a certain energy that's created in the room or just there's a palpable sense of the event because the audience is there. I don't know how else to describe it, but
well, it feels like at best it feels like there's a bunch of people with you, like you know, like on your side,
like,
you know?
Like we're going on the journey and they're with us like on the journey too, or something like that.
Yeah, there's that. But also it's encouraging because, you know, to do this kind of music, you really, I mean, it's not like how we make our living or anything. It's because, you know, we have this really deep desire to do it. And it's actually like a really weird kind of music that's hardly anybody understands what it is, or hardly anybody buys the CDs or comes out to see us play. And when we do get an audience that is with us and wants us to do what we do, it's the greatest experience, the greatest feeling ever.
And even though I said we prefer if they're not like yelling and screaming while we're playing, but
yeah,
when we get the opportunity to talk to people who come out to our shows or fans of the music and get some feedback from them, it's very gratifying, and it kind of makes it more worthwhile. Because like Chuck said, it's almost like a thankless task, and we do it because we're just driven and our love of the music. But we find that it actually touches someone or there's other people who understand and can relate to it the way we do, it makes it just encourages us to want to do more and to do it better.
Has anyone told you something after a concert or sent you an email or sent you a letter or something that made you think about the music very differently?
Well, it's been a while. The first thing comes to mind is years ago when music would get reviewed more widely. I remember reading a couple of reviews that gave me a unique or a better insight into what the music was all about. And most of the people, I think after the concert, they're too wiped out, or maybe they can't articulate or talk about what they're feeling, because it's usually we play for a whole hour. Well, you came up with when we played at the Sellersville Theater, didn't you hear somebody overhear someone say, "Boy, time really flies when you're spacing out." That was a nice comment.
I feel like we should put that on T-shirts, don't you think?
Yeah, it was $1 million idea right there, Jeff.
Well, that's just the thing. I mean, I'm always just sort of wondering. I suppose it's the sort of conundrum of any kind of creative act, is that like once you make something and put it out into the public, you never know what kind of impression it's going to have on people. So I was just kind of curious if you've been surprised by people's reaction to what you do, if it's been like, "Oh, that's not what we meant." Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. Maybe everybody's right with you.
Well, I think it's ambiguous. We intentionally make it ambiguous enough that I think it's part of, I mean, certainly I think it's part of our intention that someone could discover something in the music that we didn't know was there, and that maybe we didn't exactly put in on purpose, or we put it in on purpose, but we didn't really know all the aspects of what it could mean. And therefore, I mean, I think that the best art actually has that openness that the listener brings some of themselves to it, and that the experience they get is not just something that's handed to them by the musician, but that they have to meet them halfway. And so we try to design our music to be somewhat ambiguous, to be a bit open-ended, that the listener can project some of themselves on it, as well as hopefully, you know, take something from that we're showing them. And so we can learn new possibilities and meanings and new reactions that we didn't anticipate, but we did kind of intend that and allow for that possibility to occur.
Well, that might tie in with a lot of your sort of, again, doing these things as live performances or radio performances, that, you know, one might say that a lot of art, it's not done until someone experiences it on the other side.
And, well, some say it's not done until somebody buys it.
There you go.
Frank Zappa said that.
Right, well, right, exactly. It's like,
he was a wise man.
Right. But that is an interesting thing, in that the current sort of marketplace for this kind of music is certainly changing. One might say shrinking. And I mean, once again, I guess it goes back to, you know, something you talked about before, but it's like, you know, given that there seems to be less popular enthusiasm for this style, and it's been going for a long time, the novelty is a little off of the exciting, you know, new bold frontier of electronic music and synthesizer music. So why keep doing it?
Well, because it's sort of analogous to the synthesizer, which has endless possibilities of sound creation. And so in the context of making music that way, there's just endless possibilities. Like, look at these. If you've, hopefully I'm correct when I say this. I think if anybody listens to our three albums that we've put out, Everlasting Moment, Contact Point, and Ambient Elsewhere, they will find 5 hours of really different music. There's I don't know if it was the time or the mood that we were in, or if it was an overt decision to make these albums different, but I think we covered really a lot of ground. And there's still more. I mean, there's still more. There's still more. As long as, you know, we're alive and we're we have an active imagination and we can, you know, get our instruments together, I think we're gonna keep doing this because they're... So I don't know if it's really the synthesizer is just endless, or just we as people are, you know, ever endeavoring out into these scenarios and to see what happens.
Well, also, I mean, there was actually an overt idea to make them different, wasn't there? I mean, we're talking to you on Star's End, and so you sort of kind of... I'm not sure. Actually, I'm not sure. That's interesting. I don't know how much that got borne out in the actual realization of it, but you did sort of have an idea of structuring it like a Star's End show, right? Do you think did that work? Well, actually, why don't you explain what that idea was, and then both of you can decide whether it worked.
Well, as I recall, I think when we first, or at least maybe after the first album came out, I thought, well, it would be cool if the first album was a double CD, and I thought, well, it would be cool if we made three more CDs that each would represent, all together, all the CDs would represent a full broadcast of Star's End. And so now at this point, we have two double CDs and a single CD, which equals 5 CDs. And they are all distinctly different moods, and in one way or another, I think if they do represent... I mean, you could put these in on Star's End, and it would work pretty good. You know, like there's a distinct order to them. I think the Ambient Elsewhere CD, which just came out, are the equivalent to hour 4 and hour 5 on that double disc, and... I think Art knows the exact order. Yeah. I've forgotten already.
If you want to experience the three Ministry of Inside Things CDs as the equivalent of a Star's End 5-hour show, what you do is you play the first disc of Everlasting Moment is the first hour, then Contact Point, which is a single disc, that's the second hour, the third hour being the second disc of Everlasting Moment. And actually, the middle point of that, which would be essentially the middle point of the entire thing, is a piece called Hibernation Dreams, which very much would be like getting into the deepest middle part of a Star's End show. And then, as Chuck said, second discs of Ambient Elsewhere are the fourth and fifth hours. And I think it in terms of mood and pacing, it really does work that way. I have to admit, I have yet to actually sit down and listen for 5 hours to the whole thing to experience it for myself. But I certainly urge our listeners to try that out.
Yeah, I think when we first started out, 5 CD changers were like a really big deal, you know. So I imagined, somebody will load up their 5 CD player with our 5 CDs eventually. And I don't know, they still even make those things?
I haven't seen one in a while. Well, so when are we going to hear the 5-hour performance?
Well,
you know, we were thinking about that, but I think we played a 3-hour concert somewhere, and we were just so wiped out. I think we sort of bagged that idea of playing for 5 hours straight. It was too stressful.
Right, but the 3-hour version, where we did basically the first 3 discs in that order, it kind of worked, but it also showed us how difficult it is to play a 5-hour concert. That's not
some of the your batteries just wore out.
I actually had to change the batteries on one of my boxes in the middle of the concert.
So long.
actually and metaphorically,
something like that.
And so, given that you've come to the end of 5 hours, like what can we expect?
Well, at this point, I've played a few solo concerts, and I think I'm exploring that aspect of music, is creating music that I conceive myself and have it come out the way I've conceived it. Now, I hope that doesn't sound like I didn't like playing music with art because we were, you know, collaborating. That's a great thing as well. But I really want to see what my solo music sounds like. And so I've been doing that. And actually, I'm recording a studio album of sort of going about it the same way as the Ministry of Inside Things, playing these pieces out live. And then, actually recording them in a studio setting or like outside of a live environment into a computer, and so they'll be edited. But
they've been kind of test driven.
Yeah.
Not from public.
Yeah, I think so. I guess that's just the way I am cut out to create music anymore, I guess.
And what are you doing now, Art?
Well, my musical activities cover a very wide range of styles and activities or different things that I'm doing. So, I should also point out that after the 5 hours that were released on these albums, we have, is it two or three additional hours?
Oh, yeah.
I guess we have three additional hours of music that we've composed and performed out a bunch of times and have recordings of in the can. So whether they come out as a conventional CD or maybe some other download release, but they will be out there. And those of you who have been who've come to our concerts would have heard music that's already beyond what we released on Ambient Elsewhere, which is our most recent CD. So that stuff will be out there at some point in the future. Over the next couple of years, we'll be getting it out for people to enjoy in one form or another. But I'm pursuing two widely divergent paths myself in music. One is indulging in my love of pop and rock music. I have an album out with a group called Men From When, which is sort of a 60s meets 90s kind of retro but grungy guitars kind of album. And I'm working on a new album of pop songs with some different collaborators that I don't even know what it's called yet, but I'm hoping to have it finished this year. And I've also put out, well, I haven't put them out. I've assembled actually two albums that are not released, although one of them has gotten, I've slipped a few copies around and it's gotten a little bit of airplay. One called Index of Fractals, which is more in the experimental end. It's beyond space music. It's actually music made from mathematically generated fractal images, transmogrified into sounds, and then assembled and manipulated into music that you can listen to, but I can't even describe it. But hopefully it'll be in a store near you someday. I'm shopping it around.
If there are record stores.
And I've also assembled an album of solo guitar from going from some live performances and live in studio stuff back in the 90s. And I put together an album worth of that stuff, which only a few people have ever listened to, but that might get out there as well.
Well, it sounds like a lot more music to come in various shapes and forms. And after all that chatter about it, do we get to hear some more? A little something from Ambient Elsewhere. We've been listening to an interview with the Ministry of Inside Things. And now we'll head on through from something from Ambient Elsewhere.
Yeah, this is called Love Attack. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, guys. Again, Chuck Benzel and Art Cohen, the Ministry of Inside Things, here on WXPN in Philadelphia.